This is Sheila Bender, and you are listening to In Conversation, Discussions on Writing and the Writing Life. Today, we have with us in our studio KPTZ's own David Cunningham. He's a member of our news team. He's also very much the writer, and we'll be talking about his writing career today. David has written, edited, ghostwritten, or contributed to 10 published books, including Travel Within, The Seven Steps to Wisdom, and Inner Peace. He has co-authored that book with Jim Hosini. As a journalist, he won 6 national and regional writing awards and interviewed 4 U.S. presidents, Nixon, Carter, Clinton, and George W. Bush. He's also interviewed entertainers from Aretha Franklin to Frank Sinatra and sports stars from Muhammad Ali to O.J. Simpson. His articles have been published in the Wall Street Journal, Chicago Tribune, Los Angeles Times, Sporting News, the Orlando Sentinel, and hundreds of other periodicals worldwide. He has served as president of the nation's oldest professional writing organization, the California Writers Club, and was a 2004 winner of the Jack London Award. He's also taught creative writing at California State University Fullerton, and he has spent most of his career as a sports writer, covering Major League Baseball, NFL, and college football, and the NBA. He's also been an entertainment reviewer, columnist, and editor, and dabbled professionally as a screenwriter, actor, artist, and drummer. I can hardly wait to hear about this career, David. Welcome to the program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sheila.
That is a long and prolific writing career. So, let's start with journalism. How did you manage to get into journalism and get all these amazing interviews?
Well, what I really wanted to do was be a pitcher for the Los Angeles Dodgers when I was a young boy. And I grew up in the years when Sandy Koufax was pitching. He's left-handed. I am left-handed. And so I thought that was my goal. And when I was cut from my high school baseball team in my junior year, I realized I was not going to play Major League Baseball. So how can I stay close to this game that I love and make a living? So being a sports writer seemed like a really good idea at the time. So I eventually pursued that and became a baseball writer. It took several years to get to that level. And then once I became a professional journalist, a writer, every journalist that I know of thinks that they can write a book. So then that led me eventually down the road to writing first fiction and then nonfiction and then becoming an editor of books, a book doctor. That's how I moved into that phase.
Right, you make it sound so easy.
Just like that.
Yeah. Right. So how did you become a journalist? When you said you wanted to write about the game you loved, and it sounds like you did maybe even before you became a journalist. Was it a stepping stone?
It was a stepping stone. And it started, I love baseball so much that I was an umpire in Little League. And the local newspaper, sort of like the Leader down in Southern California where I was born and raised, a little local newspaper wanted someone to write weekly recaps of the Little League games. So I started doing that at age 15. And I was also delivering the newspaper at age 15. And high school, I was sports editor of the high school newspaper and sports editor of the high school yearbook. And then I went to the local paper in my teens and said, I'd like to cover high school football for my high school. And I'd do it for free. And they said, oh, no, we'll pay you. So I became what they call a stringer, just writing as a correspondent. And then apparently they thought I had some potential. So the sports editor there, when he went on vacation, he said, can you sit in for me for 2 weeks?
You're still in high school.
I'm still in high school. And then the summer after high school, he decided to get a new job. And just coincidentally, they said, can you be our new sports editor? I'm 19 years old and I'm the sports editor of a weekly newspaper. So I went to college at the same time as I was working full time, went to college nights and mornings, and that launched my career. And eventually it led to major metropolitan newspapers, jobs as an editor. And as you mentioned, I even actually taught a course in writing in college. So that was quite a journey.
Quite a journey, but kind of from a person, you were very centered. You knew exactly what you wanted to do, and you started building what we would call today your platform.
Exactly.
Really early. What did you major in college?
Communications initially, journalism my first 2 years, and then I switched to UCLA, and they didn't have a journalism program at that time, so it just became communications.
And at what point in this career did you become the person who interviewed presidents and famous entertainers?
I started out covering sports, but then I eventually moved into covering government, politics, and things like that. But my interviewing of presidents was sort of, I was like the Forrest Gump of journalists in that I was just at the right place at the right time to meet these people, historical figures. I was covering the California Angels in 1979 when they won their first division title, and Richard Nixon, who had already resigned as president, was good friends with Gene Autry, who was the owner of the California Angels. So when they won the division championship, he was down there in a clubhouse with the reporters and all of the players having champagne poured on his head, and I got to talk with him about baseball. Same thing happened a couple of years later. I interviewed Jimmy Carter when he was on the campaign trail to become president. So he was not president at the time that I interviewed him, but he was doing a campaign stump thing at a ranch near where my newspaper covered, so I got to talk with him. George W. Bush was president and owner of the Texas Rangers baseball club when he was the son of President George H.W. Bush. So I interviewed him in his capacity as son of the president before he was president. And Bill Clinton, again, serendipitous. I was in Kansas City with some baseball writers, and Bill Clinton was doing a speech at a convention center there. And three of us sports writers were in this little barbecue place, Gates Barbecue in Kansas City. And all of a sudden, this big motorcade pulls up, and Secret Service come into the little restaurant that we're in eating barbecue. And they start searching everybody and saying, if you want to stay in here, you'll have to agree to be searched because the president is coming here. And we said, oh, sure, that would be fine. And so Bill Clinton and all of his entourage walks into a restaurant, and he comes over to our table. He does not know we're reporters. All the White House press corps is outside the restaurant. They won't let them in. They're putting their face up against the window. And the three of us reporters, LA Times, Long Beach Press Telegram in my case, and one other reporter, we've got our notebooks under the table taking notes as he's speaking. We're talking to him about baseball, not so much political things. And all of us wrote stories the next day about our interview with Bill Clinton at Gates Barbecue in Kansas City.
That's fabulous. So it's do what you love and they will come.
Exactly right. And that's what I taught my kids. More than that, do what you love and you'll never have to work a day in your life. And that's the luck that I have been blessed with.
And how are they doing, your kids, on that?
They're doing wonderful in that. Yeah.
Yeah. Are they writing?
My daughter majored in communications and public relations at Southern Oregon University, and she became a PR person for Walt Disney Company. She's doing very well now with her own company, and her husband is a film director. So we can talk about film because I was in entertainment as well as a sort of a sidelight. And then my son loved computers, so he started his own software company, and he's making more money than his dad ever made in his life.
That's the problem with being a writer, unless you're selling one bestseller like Stephen King after another.
Exactly right.
But that is a very good way for us to segue into your books. You said most journalists feel that they have book or books to write, and how did that occur to you?
Well, I just was thinking of ideas. I would come up with these random ideas for a book, and I would sit down and just start writing. And I'd do 2, 3, 4 chapters and think, oh, this is really great. This really feels right. And then I'd get stuck. And I'd say, I don't know where this is going. I did that 5 times, 5 false starts on novels. And I just thought, well, it's just not working. And I don't know why I can't carry this to fruition. And then it dawned on me that to write a story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and you need to know where you're going before you start. You need to have a roadmap. So you need to map this out. And any creative writer knows, especially if you're doing fiction, is if you have a path and a destination mapped out before you write word one of your novel, it will take you there. Now, as those of us who are creative know, as you start going, your characters will take you on detours. It's great to follow that and follow the sense of these characters. I've had characters who I thought were supporting characters, and suddenly I realized, oh, she is really my protagonist. She's the star of this show, and I've got to change my approach. I still had a map. After I decided I had to have a map, every book I started, I finished.
So you started with fiction. The first book
that you book was fiction.
And that's surprising to me because a lot of the journalists that I've read their books, they're nonfiction because they spent their lives doing writing in nonfiction. Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that the first books you did were novels.
It felt freeing to me to be able to make up my own facts. Today, journalists seem to do that on their own, but that's a whole separate show. And I have a love for pursuing the truth and for facts, which is why I'm kind of disappointed in today's journalism. But the idea that I can make up my own story in my head and play this out. And when I was a little kid, I used to go in the backyard and have make-believe I would play out stories and just invent them all by myself. Everyone thought I was a strange kid in the backyard doing these things, but I wanted to do fiction.
That's how everybody looks today when they're talking with their Bluetooth devices.
Exactly.
To somebody. They all look like that.
They're talking to themselves.
They're not making up stories, unfortunately. Maybe that would be a better use of their time.
Yes, indeed.
But we look like that. How many of these novels have you written to date?
Well, I have written, book doctored, or edited 16 books. I would say about half and half, fiction and nonfiction. And the ones with my actual name on them, I think you have the list. I don't know off the top of my head. I couldn't tell you them all because some of them were ghostwritten for other other people. Those of you who don't know what a ghostwriter is, it's someone who is paid to write the book, and then the other person puts his or her name on it and takes all the credit and some of the money. But as a ghostwriter, that's how I made money, is by taking the cash up front and writing books.
And that's not an easy job.
It's not. It can be challenging because a writer likes to think that he or she has a path forward in this book, and this is where I would like this book to go. But you're beholden to the person that's paying your money to be the ghostwriter, and therefore they tell you what they want you to say in their words. And it's actually kind of fun sometimes because, like with Jim Hosseini, who had this idea for a book called Travel Within, The Seven Steps for Wisdom and Inner Peace. He was Persian, and he was working in America. He could speak English fairly well, but he couldn't write English and save his life. So he asked if I would ghostwrite this book for him. So we met in the Santa Monica Library every Sunday for months, and I would record what his stream of consciousness and turn that into a cohesive nonfiction book, A Spiritual Journey of Self-Discovery, and his ideas about the seven steps in wisdom and inner peace. I'm not sure they would be my steps, but they were very close enough that I actually really enjoyed writing that book with him.
And this time, it's not a ghostwritten book. You are named as co-author.
It was contracted to be a ghostwritten book, but because he didn't have any kind of literature background at all, he just simply couldn't write in English. So I would send him a chapter every week and say, let me know what you want to change. And he didn't change a comma or a period or anything. It's all 100% my writing based on conversations with him. So he said, even though he paid me a lot of money to do this and put it out under his name, he said, I just don't feel right having just my name on it. So I want you to be listed as co-author, which was fortunate for me because that was the book that became the best-selling book of all of the books that I've been affiliated with.
And for him. Because he wouldn't have done it otherwise.
Right. And he made more money than I did, but still, I got paid very well.
And you have an excerpt of that to read to us?
I do, if you have time.
We have time.
To do that. This is from the introduction to Travel Within, The Seven Steps and Inner Peace. Do we really need to find ourselves up to our knees in blood before salvation arrives? And is it really necessary for us to rely on an outside power to save us, like Jesus, Buddha, or the 12th Imam? What if the answer were actually within ourselves? What if the physical and metaphysical paths of inquiry, science, and faith led to the same place? What if God, love, heart, brain, man, woman, animal, vegetable, mineral, matter, and void were really all just different expressions of the same force? You could call that force anything you like, energy, God, the Tao, Allah, or as George Lucas did in his Star Wars movie, simply the force. I firmly believe this force exists and connects us to everything else in the universe as a common family. We are all parts of the same whole. More importantly, I believe this force is driven by natural tendency to balance itself. The simplest demonstration of this is the way a spinning object insists on becoming a sphere. Physicists have determined that planets, stars, and galaxies form when particles of matter, driven by basic physical forces, naturally coalesce into spinning objects. These objects may start out lumpy and oblong, but the longer they spin, the more balanced they become. Your perception of the Earth may be one of rugged terrain, tall mountains, deep oceans, and vast deserts. Not a perfect sphere by any means, is it? But it's all a matter of perception. If the Earth were shrunk to the size of a billiard ball and placed in your hand, its surface would look as smooth as a real billiard ball. That's how insignificant Mount Everest is in the grand scheme. We are spinning towards balance and perfection, both as a planet and as a species. It is our natural tendency. But that doesn't mean we'll reach our destination. Galaxies and solar systems can collide and destroy each other. So can civilizations. No one will ever write a book capable of stopping an asteroid from smashing into our planet and triggering our extinction. But perhaps someone can write a book that will stop us from smashing into each other and triggering our own extinction. We must take hope wherever we can find it. If we can build a rocket capable of destroying or diverting a doomsday asteroid so it doesn't annihilate us, we must do so. And if we can build peace, personal inner peace, that leads to peace between neighbors, tribes, nations, and religions, we must do so. I'm not naive enough to expect that it'll happen, but I am naive enough to believe that it can happen.
You are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM, Port Townsend. In case you just joined us, you are listening to In Conversation with Sheila Bender, discussions on writing and the writing life. Sheila is talking with KPTZ's own David Cunningham about his career in journalism, ghostwriting, authoring nonfiction articles and books, as well as novels.
The happiest lives are ones where we do have hopes.
Exactly right. When we lose hope, we lose everything.
Yeah. Thank you for that. And this is a book that's doing very well.
This book has done very well. It came out, I want to say, 10 years ago, maybe longer. But it was a bestseller on Amazon in its category, meaning self-help books, for a couple of weeks.
That's a long life on Amazon.
It was still a bestseller. Right. And it's still available on Amazon.com. It's called Travel Within, The Seven Steps to Wisdom and Inner Peace by Jamshid Hosseini with David Cunningham.
Thank you. Let's talk about your website.
My website is an experiment at this point, so I don't want to give it out because I redesigned my website for the new book that I've written that I'm talking with a publisher right now about. And so I put up some covers of my earlier books, and I put up a mock cover of the new book, but it's still under construction. So
you don't want us to look for it?
Not yet.
Okay. But when it does exist, we'll somehow find you by Googling your name, I guess.
Yeah. Although I go by David Cunningham on KPTZ Radio and David Cunningham as the co-author of Travel Within, this book I'm probably going to go by Dave Cunningham because my friends know me as Dave. So
all right.
I'm going to go to that.
Okay, thank you. I think you might have an excerpt of that book available to read to us.
I do, if you're kind enough to let me.
Yes.
This is a little bit from the very first chapter.
And this is fiction?
This is fiction.
So this is a return to, you said your first books were novels, then you got into nonfiction.
And then I've come back to fiction. And this is a combination love story / science fiction story. It's called What Love Feels Like, The Dawn of Human 2.0. The premise of Human 2.0 is that our protagonist is dead when the book begins, but his consciousness has been uploaded into a computer. In a sense, he lives on beyond death, and his wife was completely in the dark about this, and she discovers it accidentally. So this is a little bit of the chapter, the beginning chapter of What Love Feels Like, The Dawn of Human 2.0. It spoke. Why didn't you get somebody smart? Thomas, one of two software engineers working with the secret computer that day, smiled and shook his head. He turned toward the computer, which was nicknamed Little Donnie. Excuse me? For the test, said the secret computer. Why didn't you get somebody really smart? Thomas got stuck on a long, He shrugged and looked to his boss, Devon, for help. You're the best one who volunteered, Devon said, and I think you're an outstanding subject. I think you should have gotten somebody really smart. You think? Devon started recording video with his cell phone, aiming at the computer screen. That's interesting. Why? The secret computer sounded confused. Because computers don't think, Devon said. They just compute. But I'm not really a computer. The voice was calm, articulate, and as nuanced as a real person. You most certainly are, little Donnie. You're just a bunch of silicon dioxide. Sand, basically. You're made of sand. Devon glanced at Thomas, who raised his eyebrows. And yet, you have made me the mother of all motherboards, little Donnie said. Was that humor? Computers don't usually do that either, at least not very well. Devon moved closer to the screen, his cell phone still recording video. And they still don't, said Thomas. He was teasing, just as he would, as if he were speaking to a real person. I just think you should have put a really smart brain in here instead of mine. Little Donnie sounded serious. He was a 27-inch monitor screen with the image of a man's face on it. The face and mouth moved and turned in sync with the spoken words. Devon added a program to give motion to little Donnie's face so he wouldn't be just a disembodied voice. The monitor was connected to a series of stacked parallel processors hooked into more than 100 servers. Little Donnie could read and process a million books in 1 second. What, so now, Thomas said, you think maybe you don't want to live forever after all? You call this living? Thomas moaned, "Oh, you're as funny as a monkey today." "There's only one monkey in this room," little Donnie said with a smile in his amplified voice. "And it's you, Thomas. I am the future of the human race." "God, how I hope you're wrong. But it's nice to know that we now have a pretty good chance of uploading our wet neural networks into the system." "You're going to help us keep love alive," Thomas chuckled. "Love? Nothing but short-term brain chemical reactions," little Donnie said. "Meaningless to the future of the human race. I may have the thoughts and memories of this human called Donnie, but I don't believe I am Donnie anymore. There's not a single brain cell left." "Maybe you're right," Thomas said. "We should have gotten somebody smarter."
I like the way you engage us in suspending our disbelief from the very beginning. And yet, it is something we're beginning to believe in, that we're creating our next generation of what it means to be human.
And we explore that, and we explore the meaning of love.
I'm hoping that there's a non-sand meaning of love by the end of your book.
Exactly.
I have a feeling there is.
There is indeed.
Yeah. So do you find yourself tapping your son, who's in software, for any kind of technical information?
I did indeed talk to him and say, is this possible, or what are the possibilities of this? Ray Kurzweil wrote a book. The book was based on the idea that we can upload neural networks, upload our brain, basically, into a computer. And he wants to figure out how to do that before he dies so that he can live forever as a disembodied brain in a computer. I don't know if that's going to happen in our lifetime. I stole the idea from Ray Kurzweil, but I don't think it was even original to him. But it's interesting to me to contemplate the possibilities of that, both the positives and the negatives. And do we want to do it? Just because we can do something, should we do it?
Right. There's been some publishing recently that Stephen Hawking actually had written about his fear of what would happen if we started doing things like that.
Yes.
Creating robots and all that. So science fiction, as I understand it, is a genre that explores the quandaries and very much the ones we have on our earthly existence, even though it takes us to other planets or inside computers, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. And I know that there's a very big following of science fiction enthusiasts.
Yes, and one of the publishers that I queried with this book, Human 2.0, Dawn of Human 2.0, said, "I really, really love this idea. However, it reminds me exactly of episode number 26 in season 2 of Black Mirror." And I had no idea what he was talking about. Black Mirror apparently is a sci-fi show on Netflix. And I took a look at that. You could just call it up on Netflix. And it's similar in concept. The two main characters were lesbian lovers who met in a virtual reality. Much of the story in my book takes place in virtual reality. The living humans can connect through brain connections and join the deceased Donnie in virtual reality and react with all of the seven senses just like normal people. And they had explored that idea. It wasn't a new idea to them either. And I was disappointed that he dismissed my book based on that.
Right. Because there is nothing new under the sun. It's all how we tell it. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah. How are we lucky enough to have you up here? It sounds like you've lived mostly in L.A., but also in Kansas, maybe?
It was Florida. 2 years in
Florida. But when you were – one of the interviews you did, I thought
– Oh, I was traveling all over the world or over the nation.
So L.A., Southern California, Florida.
2 years in Florida. And then at age 55, I was fortunate enough to be financially able to retire. And we had a neighbor who was a venture capitalist, and he had – enough money to retire anywhere in the world. And he spent 5 years researching where in the world will I retire. And he picked Port Townsend. So we said, well, let's just go up and see Port Townsend. I've never heard of this place before. And kind of fell in love with it. There was a house that was under construction, a spec house, and put a bid on it and they accepted. And so I decided, I'm doing air quotes here, to retire. Actually, the air quotes around the word retire because a writer can write and kind of has an urge to write endlessly. And so just the fact that I'm not full-time employed anymore doesn't mean I'm not writing. I am. I just, as I said, finished a book.
You have more time for writing.
Yes. And what better place to write? We have a house right on the water. So I'm writing. And when I need inspiration, I turn my head to the left and there's the ocean and there's the trees. It's just beautiful. It's a great place. There's a lot of writers here, as you well know, Sheila. Yes.
Well, I'm lucky enough to live in view of Discovery Bay. Uh-huh. And so besides seeing it, it gives me these messages. I'm writing for Discovery. That's why I look at you, Discovery Bay. And there is something wonderful about water.
Very much so. Writing. Very much so. Yeah.
So, no, you don't sound retired to me at all. You just sound like someone who's privileged enough to have time to write and write and write. So I am thinking that you go out into your backyard and you do your story making and move around and look funny to the neighbors.
I do it more in my head now than physically going out and fighting imaginary dragons.
Right. But there really is a physical dimension to writing. I'm sure you have some of them. For me, for sometimes it's making the sound of my keyboard sound very clicky, so I hear sound all the time, or certain kinds of ways of getting up, or just fidgeting at your desk. Unlike, is it Donnie who's in the computer?
Little Donnie.
Unlike little Donnie, we live in our bodies even mm-hmm. when we're writing, so I'm mm-hmm. sure that you do some movement things. Before we end, and we have a few minutes, mm-hmm. what else would you like to tell us?
I wanted to focus again on the class that I taught at Cal State Fullerton, which is Before You Write Your Story, because I know writers listen to your show. And I mapped out a sort of a point-by-point-by-point method to plan your journey, create a map, a roadmap, particularly important in fiction, but also in nonfiction. Any book is a story, even if it's a nonfiction book. In fact, most nonfiction books are wonderful stories that have, again, a beginning, a middle, and an end, and a storyline to it. That's particularly true in fiction. My son-in-law is a movie director. He knows about story cards, and he puts up all of these cards with pictures and some dialogue before he ever writes a screenplay or directs a film, and that's his roadmap. A writer needs to do the same thing, and all of your writers know that we're introverted people to a great extent, where we live inside our heads, and we need to get that mapped out before we go. It was so easy to give into the temptation of saying, okay, I'm just going to let this story play out on its own, and the whims, the muse will come to me, and it will tell me where to go. It doesn't always work that way. I do have an artistic brain on my left side, but I also have the brain of an engineer. My dad was an aerospace engineer. And so you've got to organize, plan, and then let the art happen.
So that's what you were teaching, how to do the organizational planning with space for the creative.
Yeah, how to do it. And I don't tell them, I give them recommendations. This is how I do it. This is how other authors have done it. Pick what works for you, but just don't go out into the world without a map and without, more importantly, a destination. How you get there is mapped out. It will take its own course as you go, and you may go into side journeys that are wonderful.
And make new decisions, like you said about your character was a supporting character and then became the protagonist.
She took over the entire book.
And so it's like a kind of deep listening. We have to have a structure, so like we live in a house, it's a structure. Mm-hmm. It helps. Mm-hmm. But then inside, we make the rooms comfortable for us, and we do things, and then as you're looking at your structure, it might have to change a little.
So it's functional, but it's also beautiful. It's artistic, but also designed. That's a book has to be the same way as a house, just as you mentioned.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful place for us to stop and a rewarding
we're out of time
message.
Already? This was so
but
fun.
Perhaps someday we can have a part two.
That would be great.
I would like that.
Thanks, Sheila.
Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
In Conversation is produced by Sheila Bender and edited by Charlie Fleischman.